evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, March 23rd, 2017. A Human Rights Watch researcher accuses South Sudan Army of continuing to attack civilians in famine-stricken areas.
People are fleeing the famine-afflicted areas in Lair and Mayendit, partly because of hunger, but also because they continue to come under attack from government forces who have been deliberately attacking civilians since the famine was declared on February 20th.
And the government in Juba agrees to review work permit fees for foreigners.
Let them study and find out exactly what are the charges in the region. If they find that they are not in conformity, they will have to conform and then make necessary recommendations accordingly.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A researcher with the Human Rights Watch says government forces continue to attack internally displaced people in the former Unity State despite declaration of famine there. After meeting with IDPs in the southern part of the state last week, Jonathan Panwell says families continue to flee on foot or by boat to escape the violence. He says the IDPs are in desperate need and depend largely on international aid.
And what we're seeing now is that people are fleeing the famine-afflicted areas in Lair and Mayendit, partly because of hunger, but also because they continue to come under attack from government forces who have been deliberately attacking civilians since the famine was declared on February 20th, in addition to creating obstacles to the delivery of aid in those two areas. So, you know, we're really talking about a horrendous situation at the moment with lots of families fleeing on foot or on by canoe to the safety of those islands, but without food. Lots of people who are now forced to eat the roots of water lilies, just as they did in 2015 when they were displaced from this big offensive that the government did on formerly opposition-controlled areas.
And Jonathan, I understand that you had a chance to speak directly with IDPs. What exactly are they telling you?
I mean, everyone is tired. I mean, the people I met had just arrived to the area of Nial following several days of walking through the swamps. Those are mosquito-infested swamps with snakes and with lots of wildlife. Those people had to flee from their homes often early in the morning without being able to salvage anything from their homes as they were coming under attack from government forces. The situation for those people is quite desperate, and that's what they were all telling me. They were saying that they needed food, that they felt betrayed by the government, who once again, after providing them with some assurances that they would be protected, decided nonetheless to continue to attack not only them but also their livelihood, which you know ultimately is at the very root of this famine. There would be no famine right now in Southern Unity were it not for years of constant attacks by government forces against civilians and against the livelihoods of those civilians, namely by burning villages, by killing people who are venturing out into their fields to cultivate. So, you know, those people are really, they're really at the end of the rope. I think after 3 years of war, they want peace, they need peace, they need government forces to stop attacking them.
This is a very desperate situation, as we've heard time and time again. But how are they surviving? How are people surviving? Are there any coping mechanisms?
I was able to meet with lots of families who basically had to rely on the roots of water lilies to feed themselves and their families. Those are poorly caloric roots that people scavenge in the swamp. But for now, I mean, people are just waiting. People are waiting for food distributions. People are trying to find out where their relatives are because a lot of people had to flee. They're not too sure where their husbands or where their wives are. A lot of people were separated. So it's a truly, truly desperate situation. I think people don't really know what to do now. They're exhausting a lot of their options. At this stage, after 3 years of war, it's horrible to go there and see people who have been displaced once, twice, thrice, who are now facing, famine, who have to try and feed their children, who see their villages attacked. you know, this is a perfect storm. This is man-made, and it's quite unfortunate that up until now, people responsible for that have not suffered the consequences of their actions.
Based on what you saw and based on your analysis, is this situation going to get any better anytime soon?
Well, unless the government, you know, clearly allows humanitarian actors to access the famine-afflicted areas, stops attacking villagers and civilians, returns the cows that were stolen in 2015 during this large offensive, I don't quite see how this situation will get better, unfortunately.
That was Jonathan Pedno, a researcher for Human Rights Watch. He was speaking to Ayen Bior earlier today from Oslo, Norway. Following widespread criticism, the South Sudan government is reviewing a recent order to dramatically increase work permit fee for professionals or business class workers from a few hundred dollars to thousands of dollars. The cost of processing a passport rose from 315 to 4,400 South Sudanese pounds, and the government upped landing fees for international aircrafts from $240 to $4,000. Waki Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
Information Minister Michael Makwe says the decision to review the fees was reached during a Tuesday cabinet meeting. He says the cabinet directed Finance Minister Stephen Diudau to report back on recommendations of the review. Speaking by phone from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, earlier today, Makwe says the government wants to ensure that the new charges are similar to those levied by other countries in the region.
The Minister of Finance has been directed to set up a committee to research and to receive complaints and to present a report to the cabinet meeting urgently for consideration.
Makwe says the committee will look into all new fees. The Labour Ministry began charging for work permits earlier this month and will consider aligning those fees charged by other governments in the region.
Let them study and find out exactly what are the charges in the region. If they find that they are not in conformity, they will have to conform and then make necessary recommendations accordingly.
The circular issued by the Ministry of Public Service on 2nd this month increased work permits of foreigners from $300 to $10,000. Fees that used to cost $100, $150, and $300 now cost $1,000, $2,000, and $10,000 respectively. Makwe says the Labour Ministry was enforcing a resolution passed by South Sudan's National Parliament. The government also increased the charges for nationality cards from 45 to 630 South Sudanese pounds. Juba resident Kenyi Asin Abdallah says it is wrong for the government to jack up work permit fees at a time when the country is in dire need of relief aid provided by international aid agencies.
Increasing the work permit from $100 to $10,000, that one's very bad, especially when they have called for famine. In South Sudan, this one can limit humanitarian assistance to reach those who are in need to be helped. For this one, it prevents also a lot of NGOs from not also coming and implement some of their humanitarian projects in the war-torn country, especially the famine-hit areas.
It should be noted that the government exempted staff of diplomatic missions and United Nations aid agencies working in South Sudan from paying the higher fees. Abdallah complains that the much higher fees for nationality cards and passports are also indefensible at a time when many South Sudanese can only afford one meal per day or have no food at all.
Most citizens will be without the nationalities and also a passport, for example, the nationality, because if the government requirements will be if you want to do something, to apply for a job, to do what they need, a nationality, the ordinary citizen cannot able to get that nationality.
South Sudanese citizen Juba resident Margaret Victor says the government should have increased other taxes rather than dramatically increase fees on nationality cards and passports.
A normal citizen that work in government, sometimes they are getting their salary like 500. And when they want to acquire for nationality, it's coming to 1,000 and something. He will not afford that. It will be difficult to a normal citizen to acquire the nationality.
Abdallah says while the government reviews the new fees for work permits of foreigners, it should review higher fees for nationality cards and passports and should adjust them according to the standards of ordinary South Sudanese citizens. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Last year, President Salva Kiir appointed four advisors to work with a 26-member National Dialogue Steering Committee comprised of parliamentarians, retired military commanders, and religious leaders. The committee was to develop an agenda and a timetable for the national dialogue. The steering committee is to be assisted by a 15-member secretariat representing seven South Sudanese institutions, including the SAD Institute. Jock Madud Jock, founder of the SAD Institute, says the government needs to inject money to kickstart the process. Madud says the idea of a national dialogue is popular and the government should move very fast to fulfill its promise to the Sudanese people.
Majority of South Sudanese thought that this was a good initiative and that it should be pursued in lieu of the ongoing war and violence. The second reaction is from the skeptics, including armed opposition members, including political parties, who are not entirely opposed to it, but simply skeptical that this should be done by the government with the leadership of President Kiir. There are those who think that, conflict is going on, but that the reason why we should have national dialogue, to people who say that if this national dialogue was to happen, then we should have people who are neutral to be led by someone who meets with the acceptance from a wide variety of South Sudanese viewpoints. That kind of person is not there and cannot be President Kiir. The third reaction, of course, is from the international community, where it was initially doubted and dismissed offhand. But gradually there has developed a sense of cautious support for it.
And looking at the economic crisis in the country, it's safe to conclude that the government is too broke to finance this national dialogue because it's not easy. You cannot move from one area to another in South Sudan by road. You have to fly, and flying is very costly. So at the same time, there are people starving. So the priorities here are a little bit mixed. And if you ask some people, they will say you better give food to those who are starving and put the national dialogue aside.
Those are definitely part of the dialogue, right? I mean, that would be really the gist of the dialogue. If South Sudanese come to the conclusion that we are too hungry to engage in a discussion right now, let us straighten our priorities. First of all, let us wait until we have done something with the famine. Let us wait until we have done something with the killing fields, the military operations that are going on, the abduction of foreign oil workers and so forth, the operations by the SLA in Equatoria. Let us wait until we have dealt with these things. At least we have shown a genuine commitment to solving these issues before we sit down. If these were coming out of a dialogue, this would be well in the purview of why the national dialogue is necessary. But they should not prevent people from talking. The biggest challenge that you have mentioned, of course, is the issue of money. The country is broke, and so if the government was the only entity that was going to shoulder this, you may as well forget about it. But the hope and aspiration was that the government would show sincerity and genuineness by putting in to a pot that is managed by an independent firm some amount of money, which then will encourage donors to do likewise. Although, of course, we know that donors are very skeptical about this, and the government needs to do more to assuage the fears of the South Sudanese and of the donors that this process is genuine and sincere.
It looks like there's more on your plate to educate the people on what dialogue is all about. Dialogue is not discussion, because in dialogue, there is nobody who is right and wrong. There is no victim, there is no aggressor. It's a place where you communicate, you air your views. When I listen to government officials and rebel officials, they are accusing each other, and that is already a position. And in dialogue, you don't go with a position. How are you going to solve this process? Because there is a problem here with the process.
you have identified the gist of the problem, and that is there is a great deal of confusion among the ordinary citizenry, but also even among government officials and opposition leaders about what national dialogue is and what it is not. The onus is on the secretariat and the committee to try to flesh out what they see as the meaning of national dialogue and how it happens. One, national dialogue is not a political negotiation, so presenting political positions is a non-starter. A national dialogue is not a power-sharing negotiation. A national dialogue is not aimed at people ending up in public office. National dialogue is a process where South Sudanese are given a leveled playing field for them to state what they see as the problem with the country, what they see as how South Sudan got to this unenviable position, and how South Sudanese think they should steer their way out of this mess.
That's Jock Madud Jock, founder of the SAD Institute. Tomorrow in the second part of this interview, Madud talks about the importance of freedom of speech in the national dialogue. He was speaking to me from New York on Monday. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a safe house for abused South Sudanese women has been formed in Torit. Find out when. We come back after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how old is your oldest relative? What is their health secret?
One of my oldest relative is 112 years, and the secret of that, because he's eating the national food. He don't drink, he don't smoke, and he exercise a sport.
My oldest relative is my grandma. She's almost like 70-something. And her health secret is she keep it traditional with the food, especially. Like, she always gets the traditional food, and that's what she like the asida and the greens.
That will be, I think, 95. And their secret was the diet. They ate a lot of vegetables and less of meat.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC. We are also on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan or download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on VOA Africa.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. A news center called Safe House has been opened in the Imatong State Capital, Torit, for victims of sexual violence and other forms of abuse. A top UN official is encouraging South Sudanese women and girls suffering from abuse not to be afraid to speak up and seek help at the center. Dimo Silva Aurelio has this report for VOA from Torit.
Residents and local officials say cases of sexual violence, including rape, forced marriages and physical assaults, are widespread in Imatong State. They say many victims do not report being abused, but later are identified after seeking medical treatment at local hospitals. An abuse victim we will call Ibwaha Alam, in order to protect her identity, says she finally divorced her husband after he beat her repeatedly.
My husband involved in drinking alcohol. He began beating me every day, and there's nobody who could help me. If I went to run to someone's house, they will tell me, you are a married woman, you will not go there. Then there's nowhere that I can go, I go back to him. I can stay with him like 2 days, 3 days. Again, he will begin beating me. I was just seeing that this thing is too much. If I'm still staying here, one day I'll find myself that I'm dead. Then I decided to go home to my father's house. I was just staying there. And my father is too old. You know, in our culture here, your relative cannot involve themselves in your home affairs with your husband. So when I went home, I told my father that enough is enough. I have to stay with you here. So I was staying at home. One day my husband came with a gun, wanted to shoot me.
Alam says she is in no hurry to remarry after divorcing her husband, but life is not easy.
Since that day, I was just left like that with three kids. Nobody's helping me. It is me struggling, looking for the medicine for the children, looking for food, looking for school fees.
Alam worries constantly about whether she will be able to raise her children.
Asking God, first of all, to help my children to grow well, to continue with their education, and also ask God to help me to continue looking for something for them so that they will grow well, and I hope in future they will also help me.
To help women like Alam, the United Nations Mission in South Sudan, or UNMISS, established a safe house where victims of abuse can receive counseling and other forms of advice to deal with their abuser. The Torit Safe House will employ a number of counselors to help victims of gender-based violence recover from trauma. Torit resident Ihiju Lucy says most women are reluctant to report cases of abuse to the police or to medical workers for fear of being stigmatized by the community. She says she hopes the safe house will help change attitude about victims of abuse.
There are those, like, let me call it incest, those who are like uncles, the big brothers, they may even rape these young girls. So that one, I have not seen anywhere that we can report to. But since that they have opened this office, it will be our time now to report everything here about other cases like the rape or other things. Women and girls.
Dafidika Ekai is a woman rights activist who heads the Torit-based ITWAC civil society organization. Ekai says some rape victims have committed suicide because they see no way out.
You see, when these girls are paid off, are given to forced marriage, sometimes they hang themselves, they kill themselves, because this is a man not of his age, and she's still very young. And then sometimes they run away from such a person. These are kind of the things that this center really will address, this type of issues. It's really very important. This center will not only be used as a temporary home for the victims and for survivors, but also it will provide services to the victims, especially in the side of counseling and referral to different units. For example, to the social workers when they are here, so that they are counseled, to the police for investigations when they are here. And then we said for health personnel, they have to be tested and treated.
Imotongi State lawmaker Angela Achiro says cases of abuse against women and girls have been on the rise since the fighting erupted in December 2013.
When the policy framework of the ministry was presented to us, and there was high rate of gender-based violence in the policy, so we as the parliament, we recommend that there should be a safe house for these gender-based violent cases to protect the survivors. Because when you are humiliated sexually, you are traumatized. So there should be a center whereby they could be given service like counseling.
UNMISS Chief David Sierra praised the Imotongi State Assembly for pushing to get the safe house built.
That have been instrumental in bringing it together, the reasons for it. I cannot think of a better use of UNMISS money than to support the victims of gender-based violence. And it seems to me that when you get the number of women you have in Parliament and the Imotong Legislative Assembly, along with some activists in the community and some activists within UNMISS, this is what happens.
Last week, Imotong officials announced the launch of a gender-based violence reporting toolkit, which helps social workers treat victims of sexual abuse and teaches them how to encourage victims to report crimes committed against them. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Torit.
Tomorrow is World TB Day. World Health Organization is warning that the battle to wipe out the global tuberculosis epidemic will not be won unless stigma and discrimination against TB patients is brought to an end. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva at the launch of a new WHO ethics guidance for treatment of people with tuberculosis.
Progress is being made toward achieving the UN Sustainable Development Goal of ending the global TB epidemic by 2030. The World Health Organization reports 49 million lives have been saved since 2000, but much remains to be done. Data from 2015 show more than 10.4 million people fell ill and 1.8 million died of tuberculosis, with most cases and fatalities occurring in developing countries. The World Health Organization says stigma and discrimination against TB patients hamper efforts to wipe out this deadly disease. WHO Global TB Program Medical Officer Ernesto Jaramillo says vulnerable people such as migrants, prisoners, ethnic minorities, marginalized women and children are most likely to suffer abuse, neglect, and rejection. He says this prevents them from seeking treatment for tuberculosis.
Having new tools for diagnosis and treatment of TB is not sufficient if there are not clear standards to ensure that vulnerable people can have access in a matter of priority to these tools in a way that the strategy, the NTB strategy, can really serve the interests not only of individuals, but also the interests of public health in general.
WHO Global TB Program Director Mario Raviglioni tells VOA no country, rich or poor, is immune from getting tuberculosis. He warns marginalizing patients with TB is dangerous.
You cannot eliminate a disease like TB, you know, thinking that you build walls or you isolate your country. TB is an airborne disease, travels by air. So you have a Boeing 747 that leaves, you know, Malawi tonight and it comes to Switzerland tomorrow morning, and there you go. So it has to be faced from a global perspective.
New WHO ethical guidance includes actions to overcome barriers of stigma, discrimination, and marginalization of people with tuberculosis. The agency says protecting the human rights of all those affected will save many lives and will make it possible to end this global scourge. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
That report by Lisa Schlein from Geneva brings us to the end of our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Crazy World by Lucky Dube. Have been listening to Lucky Dube with the song Crazy World. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.